Blog Talk Radio.
Well, is it finally the Russian nut that was cracked? Is it possible they finally have proof of collusion? Well, I'd like to tell you that it's true, but unfortunately for the left, the Russian lawyer who met with Trump said, I didn't have the Clinton info they wanted and I didn't work for the government, but other than that, so could it be the smoking gun that the left has got to have? I don't think that it's going to get him over the hill, to be totally honest. Here we go.
Мало кто будет на этой встрече, кроме того, что мне было сказано, что, в принципе, значит, со мной готов был...
I attended the meeting.
...встретиться.
All I knew is that Mr. Donald Trump Jr. was willing to meet with me.
Дональд Трамп-младший. При этом соотнеся, так как бы, свои фотографические воспоминания...
So when all these reports came out, I tried to remember what the meeting was about.
Что я посмотрела, значит, в статьях с их фотографиями, я могу сказать, что, по всей видимости, молодой человек, который покинул буквально минут через там 7-10 эту встречу, вышел из зала переговорным, был, видимо, господином Кушнером, и он больше не вернулся.
All right.
Человек, который
okay,
постоянно был в телефоне, сидел, читал, занимался каким-то своим делом.
Okay, not getting a lot of content out of that one, but I am here to tell you whatever that lady's name is, that I don't think this is the smoking gun that they were looking for. Although you heard when Kathy called up yesterday, and dare I say that a frequent listener to the show is totally unhinged. And I like Kathy. I like her phone calls. Kathy, you were wrong, and you were so over the top. And this idea, and I just want to challenge you, Kathy, and anybody else who believes this, that if you dislike Donald Trump and hate his guts, which I think is the situation with Kathy, although I'm sure she'd call up and say very piously, I don't hate anybody. I just hate evil. But if you hate Donald Trump, it doesn't mean everything bad that they say about him is true. And it's been a complete joke. This Russia story has been a hoax up to this point. So I don't see how it's going to change. But, you know, I don't see Donald Trump going to jail because, I mean, frankly, they were talking about getting rid of this law about adoptions. And they were not really trying to do anything else. But anyway, so let's give them the benefit of the doubt. Let's give the left the benefit of the doubt that they have stumbled across something. Let me play you a clip here, Kathy and Frankie, if you're changing, if you're refilling your baby bottle with more Irish whiskey. Let me give you ABC News here and their triumphant story about Donald Trump Jr.
We begin tonight with Donald Trump Jr. acknowledging he did meet with a Russian who he thought had damaging information on Hillary Clinton. Campaigns often seek out opposition research on their opponents, but did Donald Trump's son think he was about to get help from a Russian lawyer with ties to the Kremlin in going after Hillary Clinton? Tonight, who else was in that room, and when did his father know about it? ABC's chief White House correspondent, Jonathan Carl, leading us off.
A Donald Trump Jr. sarcastically dismissed concerns about his meeting last year with a Russian lawyer tied to the Kremlin, tweeting, "Obviously, I'm the first person on a campaign to ever take a meeting to hear info about an opponent. Went nowhere, but had to listen." While it is commonplace for a campaign official to meet with somebody offering negative information about an opponent, it's highly unusual for that meeting to be with somebody lobbying on behalf of Russian interests. The meeting, which took place in Trump Tower last June, was attended by the very top people in the campaign, not just Don Jr., but also campaign chairman Paul Manafort and Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. In the past, Don Jr. has denied having any contact with the Russians about the campaign.
It's without a question, you know, reads and smells like a witch hunt.
But Saturday, he acknowledged the meeting with the Russian lawyer, saying, "We primarily discussed a program about the adoption of Russian children." That was a line echoed Sunday morning by Chief of Staff Reince Priebus.
It seems to be on the end of the Trump individual. It's a big nothing burger.
But just hours later, Don Jr.'s story changed. He said the meeting was set up by a contact with the Miss Universe pageant in Moscow and described the lawyer as an individual who I was told might have information helpful to the campaign. He added, "It quickly became clear she had no meaningful information." The president has repeatedly denied any contact between his campaign and the Russians. After his first press conference as president-elect, as Trump moved through the crowd, ABC's Cecilia Vega asked him point blank.
"You or anyone in your campaign have any contact with Russia leading up to or during the campaign? Nothing at all?"
No, Trump said, none at all. Today, White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders said the president only learned about Don Jr.'s meeting over the last couple of days.
"No one within the Trump campaign colluded in order to influence the election."
All right, so let's get to John Carl live at the White House tonight. And John, this evening we're learning the Senate Intelligence Committee investigating Russian meddling will actually start interviewing former Trump campaign officials this week.
And Donald Trump Jr. says that he is more than willing to talk to the committee, tweeting today, "Happy to work with the committee to pass on what I know." And the top Democrat on that committee, Senator Mark Warner, says that he absolutely wants to talk to him. Donald Trump Jr., by the way, David, has now today, we have learned, hired a lawyer to deal with all issues related to that Russia investigation.
All right. John Carl leading us off.
All right. Could it be treason? There's this very weird guy. I got to find out his name, but he reminds me of William Defoe with blonde hair. I don't know if he's had a stroke, but one of his eyes is kind of scrunched up and the other one's just kind of dead open, but I'll find out his name. But anyway, this is MSNBC.
"Is the facts reported in the New York Times article come very close, if not crossing the line with
Richard Painter, former Bush 43 White House chief ethics lawyer, bona fide weirdo, very strange guy.
Respect to treason. If those facts are true, we need to find out what's true."
Strong words from the chief ethics lawyer for former President George W. Bush in the White House about just how legally significant this meeting between Donald Trump Jr. and this Russian lawyer really is. With us to talk about his claim is Richard Painter, who now teaches law at the University of Minnesota. Also with us, our friend Paul Butler, former federal prosecutor who focused on public corruption while at DOJ, prosecuting a U.S. senator and FBI agents, among others. For his part, he teaches law at Georgetown. Richard Painter, what, as it has happened, as alleged in the New York Times, what is illegal about it?
Well, we now have even more information. We are told that Donald Trump Jr. Received an email informing him that the Russians wanted to help his father's presidential campaign. He was also told that the Russians had derogatory information about Hillary Clinton before the meeting. At that point, any loyal American would have called the FBI, because we know how the Russians get derogatory information about people. It's the way they've been doing it ever since the 1917 Russian Revolution, by conducting espionage and trying to destabilize Western governments. And they've been trying to do this to us. He would have called the FBI if he'd been acting responsibly. But instead, he goes to the meeting, and he brings along to the meeting, apparently, Jared Kushner and Mr. Manafort, the campaign manager. So we've got the top three people, the top brass of a political campaign at a meeting, and we're supposed to believe that nothing happened yet. That's my answer to that. We know.
Professor
we
Butler.
Know.
Professor Butler, what?
This guy sounds so ridiculous. I found out what his problem is. He's got Bell's palsy, so half of his face is paralyzed. But anyway, I just have to assume this guy already hates the guts of Donald Trump.
How does this compare if the Clinton campaign was trying to work through local folks to get the now infamous Trump dossier? Would that have been the same thing in the eyes of the law as this? We're still all of us getting used to the notion of Russians having anything to do with American politics, of course.
That's right, Brian. So it's a federal crime to solicit a contribution from a foreign national. Trump Jr.'s defense is he went to this meeting. We now know that he knew he was meeting with a Russian operative. He says, but when she didn't deliver the goods, that's when I got up and left. Well, guess what? That's still a federal crime if you solicit, if you go trying to get information, dirt on Hillary from someone who's not allowed to participate.
And wait a minute. So dirt on Hillary is a donation. Got that? So I guess all information is worth something. Where is the outrage during this over the sale of the uranium to the Russians by Hillary or her people, the Clintons? Where's the outrage over Obama meeting with the president of the USSR or Russia and promising to help them after the election? Seriously, I mean, this is not going to go anywhere. But who is this lady? Here, I've got a little bit from Anderson Cooper, who's going to talk about Natalia Veselnitskaya.
Donald Trump Jr.'s story about his meeting with a Russian attorney in June of last year has changed a number of times. In the latest version, he says the meeting came about because someone he knew from the Miss Universe pageant said the lawyer might have information that could help the campaign, and he wasn't told the lawyer's name before the meeting. Now, we all know her name now and a few other things about her. Randy Kay has to tell us.
This is the Russian lawyer Donald Trump Jr. says he met with in June 2016 at Trump Tower. Her name is Natalia Veselnitskaya, and this was her on Russian TV back in 2014. She doesn't appear to have any official links to the Kremlin, but is a managing partner at the Russia-based law firm Camerton Consulting. Years ago, one of her clients' companies had been investigated by the U.S. Department of Justice after another Russian lawyer named Sergei Magnitsky linked her client's company to a massive corruption scandal. Magnitsky died a mysterious death in a Moscow prison back in 2009.
Of course I'm proud of him because he was brave enough to talk about it. But of course it's painful that it cost him his life.
The official cause of death was untreated health problems, though human rights activists say he was badly beaten and deliberately denied medical treatment. Following his death, the U.S. in 2012 passed the Magnitsky Act, which allows the United States to withhold visas of Russians believed to have violated human rights.
In retaliation for that law, Russian President Vladimir Putin banned all U.S. adoptions of Russian children. And that's where Natalia Veselnitskaya enters the picture. She was working to have the Magnitsky Act overturned, meeting with anyone in the U.S. who might listen, perhaps thinking that could be Donald Trump Jr.
Natalia Veselnitskaya was once married to a former Russian deputy transportation minister. Postings on her Facebook page show she does have an interest in American politics. At least one posting is anti-President Obama. Others are against former Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates, who refused to support President Trump's travel ban. And another post is critical of the Women's March. Meanwhile, the New York Times, citing an anonymous source, reports her activities and those she associated with have caught the attention of the FBI, though CNN has not confirmed that. It's unclear where Natalia Veselnitskaya is right now, though she said in a statement to the New York Times that, quote, nothing at all about the presidential campaign was discussed at the Trump Tower meeting. She said she had never acted on behalf of the Russian government. Randy Kay.
Doesn't that settle it right there? Although you can say that Trump Jr. had an intent. Would it be wrong for Donald Trump Jr.? This is not just Kathy's question. It's for any of us. Would it be wrong for Donald Trump Jr. to go to have a meeting and hope to find dirt on Hillary? Number one. Number two, if this lady is not connected to the government, what difference does it make? Anyway, I mean, I think that they've been, you know, the left has been winding people up for so long about this stuff that even the tiniest grain of apparent proof has just got people foaming at the mouth. I mean, this is like another episode of The Walking Dead, the Walking Dead leftists coming after and trying to eat Trump and his team. 523-1450-805-6180. Kelly O'Connell, glad to be with you this morning. Here's a little Oasis for you, and we'll come right back.
You said that you've never been, but all the things that you've seen slowly fade away.
I just don't think this is going to go anywhere. My feeling, my gut tells me it's not going to go anywhere. There's just not enough there. Trump Sr. is not involved, number one. Number two, nobody from the Russian government was involved, and neither did she claim to be from the Russian government, and there was no information that was whatever. But we've got a call. Thanks for the call at Kelly O'Connell's show. Who's this?
Yes, it's Tom.
Tom, good morning. Hope you're well. And what's on your mind?
Israel is on my mind. Wasn't it true that the Obama administration involved itself in the Israel campaign of Netanyahu?
Yes. Yes, and I mean,
but there's no outrage.
Well, I mean, you know, Obama was our special little, obviously mentally handicapped president who could do anything he wanted, never got in trouble. I really think that instead of having a giant opinion of Obama like everybody did in the beginning, at the end people felt sorry for him deep down, because he was so incompetent. So, for, well, you know, Obama gets a pass. Okay, fine. Just, you know, Obama should go out and mind his own business. Now he's running a shadow campaign, thinking he's still the world leader, having all of these leftists and international social justice warriors and snowflakes coming up to kiss his butt. It is more stupid incompetence. But yes, he did involve himself in the Israeli campaign, and he lost badly. He always loses when he's involved in other people's campaigns. He got himself involved in Brexit. He blew that one too. You know.
Yeah, I think Hillary did a fine job of destroying her own, you know, campaign with the things that she did in her lifetime there.
Well, what about the freaking selling of uranium? I mean, just basically giving away uranium to your supposedly your mortal enemy is Russia. What right did she have to sell, like, what was it, a 20% stake in this mine, one of the big uranium mines? But she never gets in trouble because nobody brought it up at the time, right?
You never hear anything from the mainstream media about her doing that.
Yeah, I mean, she's, well, so the main thing, Obama on a hot mic admitting or stating, I'm going to help you guys. I'm going to help you Russians. What was he supposed to be doing, setting up Amway in Russia? I mean, he was doing things against the United States interest, or he didn't have to talk that way. I can't do it now, but I can do it after I get reelected. You know, Obama always had he always seemed like a cult member. He always had this kind of shady way of interacting with people, and he, on the one hand, acted very arrogant. On the other hand, acted, in my opinion, very insecure. He never really played. He never played hardball with anybody. He was in a negotiation. The first move he made is to give them everything that they wanted. Give them all this money. Give them open. You know, allow them to continue with their nuclear program. And don't even ask for an American hostage back. I mean, you know, this is this kind of thing. This leftist fixation with failure is absolutely side-splitting if it wasn't so serious.
I'm 59 now. I never feared a president as much as I did Obama.
Well, I mean, I hope he relocates to Borneo and becomes a Buddhist monk or something and just, you know, just stays out of the way.
From your lips to God's ears. Take care, Coach.
Thanks. All right. It's not that Obama was on the opposite side, because you could argue that a lot of things Bill Clinton did were helpful to America. Maybe a lot of them weren't, but it just seemed like Obama's instinct was to always harm America one way or the other. And while he was doing it, act like he was the son of God. Like Obama had this total, I was thinking about this morning getting ready. I've never heard anybody use the term, the words I or me more often than this guy. And what did we achieve? So we put this guy, he's a narcissist, put him into office. What did we get? What did the left get? What did the Democrats get? It was the biggest collapse in offices, you know, from the local to the national that we've ever seen for the Democratic Party. They've never been weaker. So what did they get? Didn't they sell themselves sold to the devil? All right. Man doused rabbit in gasoline sets house on fire. Well, what do you expect? That is the natural law kicking him in the butt. Police in Albany, New York, have charged a man whom they say set a fire to a home, poured gasoline on a pet rabbit. The 23-year-old Albany man set a house on fire last Saturday. That's so dumb. The man doused a pet rabbit with gasoline while the animal was in the cage on the back porch. Here's a brave guy. The fire was extinguished and the rabbit wasn't hurt, but the gasoline hit the house. And wow, that's like a perfect story. The investigator said the man was only one of a few residents at the house, so he burned down all of his friend's stuff. And in controversial ceremony, three women pledge lifelong virginity and become brides of Christ. Now, I'm looking at these women, and I'm saying to myself, I don't think, you know, men are going to be jumping off cliffs because these women are vowing lifelong virginity. A couple of them are heifers, two out of three. And then only one of them looks to be that young. But anyway, on a Sunday in late June, before the altar in a Catholic church, cloaked in wedding finery, three Michigan women pledged, in the words of Catholic canon law, to be, quote, mystically betrothed to Christ. Unlike nuns who take a vow of virginity before joining religious orders and then give a normal life, Lori Malashenko, speaking of Russians, Teresa Jordan, and Karen Irvin will continue working independently, but will be dedicated to serving the Catholic Church as brides of Christ. And it goes on to outline the history of this type of thing. There were consecrated virgins dating from the earliest days of the Catholic Church, dying out in the 12th century in the 1100s. And then this rose again within the convents. If you want to have if you want to connect this to something in the ancient world, a lot of things in the Roman Catholic Church come out of Rome. You could definitely tie this into the Vestal Virgins if you wanted to. The virgins of Vesta, who served, I think, till they were in their 30s or 40s and were not allowed to have any relations with men. So anyway, 250 consecrated virgins in the U.S. and 4,000 worldwide. And, you know, I think that part of this is there's a pushback against a kind of life that people don't really enjoy, which is super saturated, a life that is super saturated with sex, but that has no true intimacy. And I have just a little clip of this for you. And this is from New York Times Live, from the New York Times website. Here's the ceremony of the three.
So my name is Karen Marie Irvin, and I was just consecrated as a bride of Christ. More specifically, I was consecrated as a virgin living in the world. We just had our consecration ceremony. This is the first time in the Archdiocese of Detroit, so it's very exciting.
it's a promise that we make to be faithful to Christ all of our life, and to make him a promise of our virginity as a gift back to him. So we become brides of Christ.
Receive this veil.
What I want to know is, are these ladies really virgins? And looking at them, my impression is probably not, but maybe they're born again virgins.
I believe you are, show that you have been chosen for other women to be dedicated to the service of Christ.
It's an ancient vocation. It's the first vocation in the church for consecrated life for women. So if you've heard of St. Cecilia or Agnes or Lucy, they were all consecrated virgins living in the world. So my vocation thrived through around 1100, and then it kind of petered out and was renewed by Vatican II.
Many people confuse this with religious life and say, are you going to be a nun? No, they're not going to be a nun, because when you become a sister, religious sister, you're committing yourself to a community of sisters, and you'll normally live in community. Whereas Lori, Karen, and Teresa are all living individually now. They're not going to change that. They'll live and do the work that they've been doing. One is an editor for a publishing company. One is a college professor of French. And the third is a high school principal.
I get to keep all of my regular daily activities, but my heart is belonging to Christ.
I take it one of her daily activities is not surfing for porn. All right, we'll take a break here and get some local news for you. 523-1450-805-6180 to text. We'll be back. Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces. Man, the Russian zombies are chomping at the bit for some human flesh. All right, tying these women, these born again virgins or whatever they're calling themselves, these Catholic virgins, to the ancient world. In Rome, there was a college. Then the Roman Catholic Church has continued this on, but there was a college of various religious orders, and there were priests and priestesses, although they did not correlate to modern day priesthood. And the reason that I say that is that there was no, for example, for the Arval Brethren, which is one of the oldest agricultural religious order, there was no, for example, call to serve the poor. As a matter of fact, that idea would have been totally incomprehensible to ancient Romans. And there was no calling for them to be virtuous or to be sacred unto the Lord. There was no central God. And one of the interesting things about Roman religion, which is from our perspective kind of incomprehensible, the Roman gods arose coextensively or at the same time with Rome. So there was never a conversation about where they came from. They were just there. And so the Vestal Virgins in this case did have a sanction on them, did have a calling on them to be pure, engage in any sexual activity. Now, there were some famous scandals that occurred when some of these women were not chaste, and it was a great crisis in the history of Rome, but not for the reasons that we would think of. Here's a little bit on the cult of ancient Rome's Vestal Virgins from Associated Press from 6 years ago.
There was once a villa in the center of ancient Rome where six women lived. They were the Vestal Virgins, and they had an important job. They had to keep alive the sacred fire dedicated to Vesta, the goddess of the hearth. Vestal Virgins were selected from noble Roman families when they were between 6 and 10 years old. They then served for 30 years. Now, after 20 years of sitting empty, the House of the Vestal Virgins has been open to the public. The first to visit the newly opened house was a group of women who study Roman traditions and dress in Vestal Virgin costumes. Adriana Serpi is dressed as the Massima Vestale, or Chief Vestal.
Una Vestale Massima. The Maximum Vestal was the oldest in the group of priestesses that was made up of 6 Vestal Virgins. She did what the other Vestal Virgins did. They kept the sacred flame burning. The fire represented the heart. The fire had to always be burning. Fire was life, so it was very important for Rome. And the punishment for whoever put out the fire was very severe. Corporal punishment.
Chi spegneva il fuoco erano molto gravi.
The punishment for a Vestal Virgin breaking her vow of chastity was also severe. She was condemned to death and buried alive. As the Vestal Virgins wander through the courtyard, they stop to take a closer look at a statue of one of the chief Vestal Virgins. The name on the statue has been rubbed off and the base has been defaced. Apparently, she was one of the few Vestal Virgins who broke her vows and was buried alive. Laura Weinstein is a tour guide. She says that for years she has been over the railing into the House of the Vestal Virgin.
All right. So anyway, we like to talk about the separation of church and state. This idea did not exist in the pagan world. And for an example, if there was a crisis and the ancient Romans considered something out of the normal order of events to be what they called monstra. Say if a two-headed calf was born, that was a sign that there was a disruption in the natural order, which meant the gods were unhappy with them. Then the Senate would contract with one of the religious orders, and they would do an investigation through these religious colleges, one of the Arval Brethren or the Flamen Dialis, which was the singular priest of Jupiter, and they would do rites. And then the Senate would decide whether they were going to accept the statements from the college. There was no freestanding religion. I mean, each house had its own cult, and they tended to venerate the elders, the parents. At one time, they say that Roman religion arose out of worship of the family. But there was no independent standing of any religion, and the Senate decided what all of these events meant, and they interpreted for the religion. So this idea of standing up against, you know, speaking truth to power did not exist in the ancient world from a religious standpoint. You have to enter into the history of the Bible to really find that independent separation of church and state goes back very early in Jewish history. The king could not be the chief priest, in other words. Anyway, we'll take a break and come back and dig into some more current news. 523-1450, I got some weather for you. A woman eating in Newark, in Brooklyn, at Peter Luger Steakhouse took a bite out of another woman's arm. Happened 4:10 p.m. and in South Williamsburg in Brooklyn. And this is posted July the 10th. The 50-year-old woman, after biting the 50-year-old woman, the hungry suspect fled the restaurant. And that victim was treated at the scene. It seems like there's a lot of weird stories out there now about things like cannibalism. All right, here is kind of a worst case scenario from Kurtz on this story, fallout from the New York Times Trump story. which I think is a good take on it.
It's the hard way that when you have a bad story, the thing to do is to get it out, get all of it out, take your lumps, take the damage, and move on. When you engage in the drip, drip, drip of partial disclosure, and what you do is that the story stretches on for weeks, it stretches on for months. The media become convinced you have something to hide. Now, I have said on this whole Russia story, again and again, I've said it on the air, I've said it on video, I've said it in print, I've said it to my friends, that it seems like there is a whole lot of smoke without much fire at the center of it. In other words, the press seeming more to glom on to allegations of some kind of cover-up, of various Trump associates not disclosing meetings, contacts with Russian officials. What does it mean? Some of this is complicated, makes a lot of the country glaze over. But there's something different about the New York Times story that ran yesterday. It was actually the second version of the story involving Donald Trump Jr. Because here, what's damaging is the admission from the president's son himself. You don't have to worry about the 10 layers of facts in the story or the media spin or analysis. Here's what Donald Trump Jr. says happened. It's back in 2016, June, when the now president's about to become the nominee. And there's a meeting that Don Jr. arranges. Jared Kushner was there. Then campaign manager Paul Manafort was there with a Russian lawyer who, as it turns out, and this is according to Don Jr.'s account, claimed that she had some damaging information about Hillary Clinton, about Russians doing some kind of fundraising or passing money to the DNC in support of Hillary Clinton. So, again, this is Donald Trump Jr.'s version. They went to the meeting. The woman didn't have much. Her statements were vague. They were ambiguous. It turned out, he says, that the true agenda of the meeting was to talk about adoption. And when we talk about adoption, we're talking about Vladimir Putin ending an adoption program in which a lot of American families brought Russian babies home in retaliation for a tough U.S. law aimed at Moscow that was passed after a Russian activist was killed under, shall we say, questionable circumstances. Having realized that this was a pretext, that's Donald Trump Jr.'s words, that the meeting was a pretext to talk about this adoption-related matter, and the woman didn't have anything on Hillary, they quickly ended the meeting. So here's the president's son saying, yeah, I met with this Russian lawyer to see if she had any dirt on Hillary Clinton. Now, I am not naive about this stuff, and neither are you. Lots of these meetings take place. Campaigns, it's kind of the seamy side of campaigns, are always looking for oppo on their opponents, but usually not from the Russians. And that's what makes this unusual. And the Times had run an earlier version a day before in which Donald Jr. Put out a statement in which he talked about, we mainly discussed adoption, didn't say anything about any oppo.
So he should have come forward, but maybe he thought it would be never discovered. I think it's much ado about nothing. Now, here is Tom Papa, Old Age. This is hard-hitting comedy.
Science is moving at such a rate, we're going to be able to stop the effects of aging. How amazing is that? There's going to be no aging at a certain point. But the real bummer, we're going to just miss it. We're going to be the last generation of old people. How awful is that? They're going to look at us on the sidewalk like, ew! Remember when that used to happen? Look at their necks. They're like testicles. Now we're at the weird stage where people are just hanging on. The doctors are just kind of working out the kinks. They're just kind of making us last longer. Like, get a load of this guy. He should have been dead years ago. I filled him with batteries and juju beads. I don't want to just last. You want to just last? People always take pride in that. Just give people in their family just keep going. Especially if they're a degenerate. Then you hear that story. They love telling that story. You know, my grandfather ate bacon every morning, smoked 3 packs of cigarettes a day, drank whiskey every night, lived to 98 years old. Yeah, and I'm sure he's a real treat to hang out with. Big bacon bag of bones with a racist ashtray for a mouth. Permanently attached to a vinyl recliner, sucking on an oxygen tank like he's scuba diving in the living room. Can we agree on that? If you need an oxygen tank, maybe it's time to wrap things up. Seriously, if the planet doesn't have air for you anymore, and your best friend is a nickel slot machine, one more lap and hit the showers. And look, we can't just keep living on. We can't. We really can't. It's getting too expensive. Social Security, Medicare, we don't have the money. We can't afford it. We can't afford to keep the old people. We need a plan, a secret plan. Don't tell the old people about it. We'll communicate through computers and whispers.
All right, so take a break here on the R. Kelly O'Connell. We'll come back and talk about something new. 523-1450-805-6180. And more great stories out there. All right, so good morning, Kelly, here in 706, and your 11th day of July. What are your predictions for the rest of the weather this summer? Are we into monsoon season yet? Feels like it could be that way. But, you know, it does kind of break things up when you get some, no matter how hot it is, if you get a little bit of rain kind of interspersed there, then it tends to be better. Now, I've got a sad story about a Texas teen who died in, I think it's in Lovington, Texas teen electrocuted after, Lubbock. Well, when I read it in the New York Post, it said Lovington, New Mexico. Anyway, they're living in New York. They don't know there's a difference between New Mexico and Mexico, or Texas and Mexico, or in New Mexico for that matter. Check this out.
Lubbock family are coping with, but they say they want something good to come out of their grief. 14-year-old Madison Cove from Lubbock died early Sunday morning in an electrocution in a bathtub at her father's home in Lovington, New Mexico.
Family members.
That's where that idea came from.
Members tell us she was in the bathtub and was either plugging in her phone to charge it or perhaps simply grabbed her phone while she was wet and the phone was already plugged into the outlet. KCBD News Channel 11's Presley Fowler joins us now with more on the message this family wants to share now tonight. Presley.
Karen and Abner, this poster has been shared on Facebook hundreds of times. It shows photos of Madison and explains what happened, but it's the words down here at the bottom her family really hopes people will listen to, teaching children about the dangers of electricity.
I call her my shining star.
A 14-year-old wise beyond her years.
She was very smart, very good student.
She is so wise. How did she electrocute herself in the bathtub?
In school, she just loved life.
Madison Coe had so much of her life ahead of her as she made an impact on those around her with her positivity and kindness. She was a basketball player and number one chair with her tuba in the band at Terra Vista Middle School.
She's just sweet to everybody, and everybody loved her.
As her grandmother, Donna O'Gwynn, fights back the tears, she says it's hard to understand why her granddaughter's life was taken far too soon. Her family says Madison was in the bathtub and grabbed her phone that was plugged into a charger in a bathroom outlet.
There was a burn mark on her hand, the hand that would have grabbed the phone, and that was just very obvious that that's what had happened.
Madison's family believes this terrible accident is something that could happen to anyone, but now their mission is to make sure it doesn't happen again.
Sounds reasonable. Too bad. Looked like a nice little girl. So you're concerned about Donald Trump Jr.? All right. So here's what we know and we can kind of move on from here. Met with a Russian lawyer. The Russian lawyer had no connection to the government. She didn't have any dirt on Hillary. Now, she might have claimed to have dirt on Hillary just so she could meet them over this Adoption Act. But the Russian lawyer herself denied having any dirt on Hillary or any ties to the Kremlin. She said, I never had any damaging or sensitive information about Hillary Clinton. It was never my intention to have that, she told NBC News on Tuesday. So anyway, this has to do with a law, I think, that came up under Obama. But she says that she denied that she had any dirt or that she promised any. And she says it's quite possible that maybe they were longing for such an information. They wanted it so badly they could only hear the thought that they wanted it. Here she says, talking about being in the spotlight. Imagine yourself in my shoes. One morning you wake up and all of a sudden you are the focus of all the high-ranking upstream media of the world. Sounds pretty sophisticated, doesn't she? To summarize, these were not the happiest days of my life, I have to say. I have to break up my holiday. I have to take a trip back to Moscow because I just wanted to be able to answer the questions myself. Probably wise. But if there's no government involvement, and here's my analysis on the dirt. They were looking for dirt. That in and of itself is not illegal. You can't say what the Trumps did or Donald Trump Jr. did was wrong. At the same time, you say it's okay that Hillary had an agreement, a secret agreement to block Bernie Sanders, right? I mean, so that's the problem with all these stories, is at some point people are put face to face with the actions of the Democratic Party themselves against this. I don't think this story is going anywhere, although it does give a little bit more fuel to the fire. All right. Switching gears, did Comey, and this is from Fox News from yesterday, another story.
It didn't dawn on me originally that there can just give these right, documents.
Here we go. Another story without words in the beginning.
Did you show copies of your memos to anyone outside of the Department of Justice?
Yes. The president tweeted on Friday after I got fired that I better hope there's not tapes. I woke up in the middle of the night on Monday night because it didn't dawn on me originally that there might be corroboration for our conversation. There might be a tape. And my judgment was I needed to get that out into the public square. And so I asked a friend of mine to share the content of the memo with a reporter. Didn't do it myself for a variety of reasons, but I asked him to because I thought that might prompt the appointment of a special counsel.
All right, here's my question for you. If James Comey was the head of the FBI and he leaks information to force a special counsel to be appointed, should this special counsel still be out there? I mean, if the FBI head broke the rules of the FBI to force a special counsel to take down Donald Trump, which is transparently what he was trying to do, which is why he would never say there was no investigation of Russia links with Trump. He wanted to destroy Trump. Should they disband the special investigative counsel? Here's a little more. Comey violated FBI policy, attorney says from Fox Business.
Former FBI Director James Comey after a new report claims more than half of Comey's memos on conversations he had with the president contained classified material. The president tweeting, quote, James Comey leaked classified information to the media. That is so illegal. The report is raising the possibility that Comey broke FBI rules by releasing classified information without permission and ignored the same security protocol as Hillary Clinton, something that he blasted Mrs. Clinton for during the 2016 election campaign. Attorney Andrew Stoltman joins me now with more, and good to have you here.
Andrew, do you think Comey did something wrong?
Well, I mean, at an absolute minimum, he violated the FBI's policy. You can't have the former FBI director releasing information that he intends to go to the media. So now the $64,000 question was, did he disclose confidential information to his source that then leaked it to the New York Times?
Mm-hmm.
That remains to be seen. But at a minimum, he showed extraordinarily bad judgment. He showed Hillary Clinton-like poor judgment. And I think this issue might be at the top of the list for Mr. Mueller when he's investigating.
Except that Mr. Mueller is like Comey's best friend, right? They're buddies, which
There's
is a whole other
conflict.
Can of worms we can get into in a second. But I want to stay on this idea because, you know, Andrew, I can tell you, I was flabbergasted by this. I don't care what side of the aisle you're on. I don't care whether you hate Trump, whether you love Trump. The idea that the guy's running the FBI gets a thought in his head in the middle of the night and says, you know what, I'm going to call up my friend at Columbia and I'm going to release these memos to him so he can go release them to the New York Times. That's messed up. And if he's leaking like that, who the heck else is leaking?
That's right. And remember how high of a standard he gets held to. He can't do the Hillary Clinton, gee, me not know what the rules are. He has a duty as the former FBI director and also the former head of the prosecutor's office in the Southern District of New York to know the rules and to follow the law. And then remember this issue as well. What did he do with these memos after he left the FBI? Did he send them on an unsecured server? Did he send them via an unsecured email address? This really opens up a Pandora's box for our highest legal officer in this great country of ours, and it'll be fascinating to see what happens.
But then the question, Andrew, is was the information classified or not, right? I mean, Trump is alleging that it's classified stuff. Comey would say, oh, no, I wrote these memos in such a way that none of it had to be classified because I knew I'd want to get out there and leak it all, basically, eventually.
Yeah.
So here's my take on this. You know, his intention was wrong. His actions were therefore wrong. Number one. Number two, he's not in a position where he's a private citizen to be leaking stuff and then claim it wasn't classified. At that level, I think doing what he was doing, whether it was classified or not, I think it was inappropriate and wrong. And is it, like, you know, I was thinking about this. What if they went after Comey and just gave him a misdemeanor to kind of put the message out there that you can't be an independent, you know, you can't be an independent contractor running the FBI. That's absurd. Here's a little bit from Dershowitz on this.
And Alan, I also want to get to this story. Former FBI Director James Comey, he's coming under fire. The Hill's now reporting over half of Comey's memos recalling conversations with President Trump contained classified information, we're learning. President Trump weighed in on this, also tweeting this earlier. James Comey leaked classified information to the media. That is so illegal. Alan, what is your take on that?
Well, I think President Trump is making the same mistake that his critics make. A, he's rushing to judgment about whether something is illegal. And second, he's trying to criminalize political differences. He doesn't like Comey. Nobody likes Comey. The Democrats don't like him. The Republicans don't like him. But I'm not so sure that what he did was illegal.
But don't forget that James Comey, Alan, excuse me if you will, don't forget, though, he said that that was private property. Those were his personal notes.
And he's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
He's wrong about that. They belong to Congress. They reflect conversations that occurred while he was an employee of the United States of America. They are the property of the United States. What he did was at the very least unseemly for a director of the FBI whose job it is to make sure there are no leaks of classified material to himself use a Columbia law professor to launder material that may have contained classified information is unseemly. Whether it's criminal or not, I think we need an investigation. We shouldn't rush to call things criminal unless they are clearly criminal. What I've said about the critics of President Trump, I say about the critics of Comey, let's not rush. Let's look at it. Let's analyze it. Let's call it criminal only if it really is criminal.
Alan, and a good point to make, that not to rush to judgment on what Comey did leak or did not leak and what was classified or what was not classified. Coming from the intelligence community, you know, there are different reasons that they might classify a document. They could be classified after he had written them. They could be classified as they're looking at them through the investigation. And again, we don't know specifically what he handed to this law professor. And most likely those documents are still kept kept at the FBI. That's where they certainly should be kept, because you're right, they are property of the U.S. government. But that doesn't mean that Comey didn't have a lot of information in his head, and that may have been what he actually shared.
Or even if he had it in his head, what's in your head and what you learned while you were the director of the FBI and what may contain information that is not available to the public should not be leaked through a law professor. So I think we are right in condemning him and holding him to the same standard he held Hillary Clinton to. We're entitled to do that. What we're not entitled to do is say it's so illegal before we hear all the facts.
And again, just to reiterate that his claim was that he did it as a private citizen, no longer
that's
a member
nonsense.
Of the FBI.
Right.
A lot of people who are government officials share their experience as government officials in biographies, et cetera, after they leave their,
but they
the
do it with
service.
Clearance. I've represented some of that.
Agreed.
You need to get clearance before you publish anything you learned as the director of the FBI. You can't just make that decision yourself.
Right.
He not only made it, but he made it and hid it.
Right.
He hid it through a launderer, through a law professor. That was wrong. It should never have been done. He should have had the courage of his conviction to stand in front of a TV camera and say, I want a special counsel appointed. Here are the reasons. Here are the memos. I'm going to give them to you in the press. Then he would have to pay the consequence. But to hide it sounds like an admission that he was doing something wrong.
Well, all right. So we'll take a break here. But what do you think there? I mean, I think obviously what Comey did wrong is wrong. And the question is, should he pay for it or should, you know, let's just say it was a misdemeanor. Let's just say they could go after him for a felony, but it's a slam dunk misdemeanor. Should they go and put that on his record just to teach him a lesson? I don't know. 722-523-1450-805-618. We'll be back.
Step outside, it's summertime to me.
All right, so I've got a clip that is a continuation. See, I had a couple of things I wanted to do. It's kind of a continuation. There was some feedback from Aaron. He enjoyed the clip that was from Jordan Peterson. And I'm trying to see. Well, I think there's like five parts of that. See here. I mentioned Marxism many times, and the problem is that a lot of people don't know what Marxism is. So I think it's important because Marxism was a huge influence on the last administration and is kind of a foundational set of principles for things like political correctness. But also the modern liberal movement is foundationally built out of Marxism. Now, I have a problem with that for a couple of reasons. Number one, Marxism was disproved a long time ago. Technically, during the life of Marx, his theories were disproved. So why have they stuck around? Because at some level, they appealed to the human sense of aggrievement, of being held down, of being punished. And we do have a call. Thanks for the call, the Kelly O'Connell Show. Who's this?
This is Steve. First time I ever called you.
Steve,
it
thank
was
you.
So sad about that woman dying.
That getting shocked to death?
Yeah, there's a device called a ground fault circuit interrupt. Costs about $10. A repeater outlet costs about $1.25. And if those had been installed in the bathroom, it would have sensed that she was going to get electrocuted and turn things off.
So should,
and she would not have died. It's cheap insurance. National Electrical Code now requires that in all bathrooms, in the kitchen, you know, within reach of the sink, and outdoor things. You could be standing in water and plug something in and get electrocuted. So, that didn't have to happen.
Yeah, I mean, it just sounds Well, obviously, she's a young lady. She was an attractive young lady, and she was ambitious, and she was, you know, she played in the band and everything. So just a crazy way to die.
But, yeah, it's a shame. The other thing I wanted to mention, Hillary.
Yes.
I have in mind that she took money from the Russians. She was taking money from everybody, for the Clinton Foundation, for the library, all of this stuff. And she didn't deliver, and that's why the Russians are doing what they were doing.
I mean, is it possible that Putin just didn't like her personality?
I don't know. I don't know, but I have in mind, you know, like I say, she's taking money from everybody. And if you don't, in the Navy, we had a term, payback will be a mother, and I can't say the last word on the radio.
Thank God. All right, Steve, I'm going to hit some local news.
Later, guy.
Thanks. Great call.
We'll call you again.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye. All right. Wow. I didn't know how that conversation was going to end there, but fortunately. All right, so let's get some of your news here. And I'm looking, actually. All right, well, this is just going to be a long set, okay? Because I was trying to kind of shrink things down. 7:30, Kelly O'Connell, local news and your weather at the same time. We'll be right back. All right, here's a clip from a guy by the name of Stephen Hicks from The Falsification of Marxism to Postmodernism. All right, Marxism was disproved along the way. So why did it stick around? It stuck around because it gave out a description of life that appealed a lot to a lot of people, that the wealthy get their money by stealing it from the poor. That's the basic message of Marxism. And that we need to remove private property from society so that people don't fight anymore. Doesn't get much more basic than that. There's falsification in Marxism from the very beginning. And to this day, Marxism seems to encourage and reward falsification. Here's Stephen Hicks.
Socialism. It's the version of socialism that really dominated left thinking. There are other ones kicking around, but they really got marginalized.
Let me go back to the very first sentence and see if he adds anything to that.
Marx and Engels, as they enunciated their version. It's the version of socialism that really dominated left thinking. There are other ones kicking around, but they really got marginalized for about a century, from 1850 up until about 1950 or so. And the label was scientific socialism. So in one respect, they did see themselves as a child of the Enlightenment, right? The world works according to certain natural laws that we can understand. And having reached an understanding, a social scientific understanding of the way the world works, we can make predictions, right, about how the phenomena are going to behave, right, in the future. So that part is exactly right. The second part of what you were saying is that, yes, part of the problem by the time we get to the middle part of the 20th century is that all of the major predictions of the classical Marxist model were not only just not coming true, but the exact opposite, right, of them seemed to be coming true. So, for example, Marx's slogan, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer. We've all heard that slogan. But what that predicts then is, in this brutal, competitive, capitalist struggle for resources that the Marxists describe the free market in terms of, you're going to have kind of successive rounds of competition. And what will happen then is some people will win and some people will lose. And the losers then will be forced into poverty. And then the winners will enjoy the spoils. But then, of course, the winners start to fight amongst each other. And then some of those then get forced into poverty. And then what you end up with is a very few capitalists at the top who are in control of all of society's resources. And the vast majority of people are forced into subsistence level, right, poverty. So that is the theory with a definite set of predictions. But then it becomes very clear as you get into the 20th century that It's not the case that we're having a smaller number of rich people right at the top of the heap. Instead, what happens is we have more and more rich people, right, developing in the free market capitalists. It's not the case that most people are being forced into poverty. Instead, what happens is the poverty rate is going down and people are being lifted out of poverty. They had also predicted that the middle class was this temporary class, that it was going to be squeezed out, right, by the free market competition.
The petit bourgeoisie.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they would become even more petite, right? Mm-hmm. but what then, of course, was happening was the exact opposite of that. The middle class, right, was expanding. So as the social science data, right, came in, and it got better as the 20th century went on, then clearly the Marxists are looking at the data, they're looking at the theory. We are social scientists, and they're recognizing that there's a major mismatch between the theory and the practice. And so that is, I think, one of the things that by the time we get to the 1950s, people are rethinking after World War II what's going to happen next. The left is rethinking. We have to do something to the classical Marxist framework because it's just not working. So what do we do? Postmodernism is one of the variations that comes
out. So how come
then
the skeptical epistemological tradition or the anti-enlightenment epistemological tradition becomes so attractive for a movement that is trying to cope with its disappointment and failed predictions?
Yeah, that's one of the more controversial, this is one of the things I get more heat from, right, in my books, right? Because then the analogy that I make sometimes for explanatory at this point is to say, if you think of socialism, it's not just a scientific theory trying to understand the world, that it also is an eschatological theory. It's a theory of high idealism that if we commit ourselves to, we are going to transform the world and create, so to speak, heaven on earth. And so all of that religious language, I think, is important to understanding the psychology, right, of people who buy into the Marxist tradition. And there always then is a question, if you have a strongly held idealistic faith in something, it's part of the fiber of who you are. What do you do when the data and the arguments and the evidence seems to be against it? Right? So if you think of people who are very religious, but they're also intellectual and they think seriously about the arguments for and against the existence of God, and the rational side of their mind saying, I don't think I can defend my faith intellectually anymore. What do you do, right, at that very pregnant moment, right, inside your head? And you have a couple of strategies. One thing is to do is to say, well, if the reason and the evidence and the logic are going against my faith, then I need to change my faith. Right? I need to get a different religion, become non-religious, right, or something like that, because it's important to get the truth, and the way we get the truth is by looking at the data and the evidence. But we also know that the other strategy people can follow psychologically is, if the evidence and the data goes against something that they really want to believe deeply, they will go on the offensive against reason. They will go on the offensive against logic. They will say everything is just semantics. Nobody really knows the truth, right? That's just your interpretation, right? That is to say, they bring in skeptical epistemological strategies or relativistic cognitive strategies, but it's a defense mechanism for a value system or a belief system that they want to hold dearly. And I do think that there's a lot of truth to that. There are true believers on the far left.
So you, when your constructions fail, you start to be a deconstructivist.
That's right. That's right. And so,
so instead of saying that we are creating a new earth and new heavens, actually, there's a Swedish author, Fredrik Ström, who wrote a five-series book called Rebellerna, the Rebels of the Social Democratic Movement's Growth in Sweden. The final book is Nya himlar och en ny jord, New Heavens and a New Earth, which is the Social Democratic Sweden created in the 20s, according to him. So when you cannot create anymore, then you have to be destruct deconstruct.
That's right. Then you become deconstructionist.
But then you deconstruct, and then also, I guess, you could become a bit of a relativist, in a sense that all cultures are equal. There is no, all truth is relative.
Yes.
And then you start to try to marry yourself into quantum mechanics or relativity theory, not necessarily by understanding it. But.
Right. Just as a rhetorical tool. Mm-hmm. Right. So to come back to the issue of science, right? We've all heard, Einstein relativity theory, right? Well, you just glom on to relativity. And then from the uninformed humanities educated, right, perspective, right, that sounds like relativism. Of course, it isn't, right? Or Gödel's incompleteness theorem. Oh, incompleteness. So that sounds like us too, right? Or chaos mathematics, right, and so forth. So it then just becomes a semantics issue, but it's really just a rhetorical strategy, I think, as you're suggesting, by people who don't really know the science, right, very well. But there is a darker streak here. I mean, the flip side of, if your theory is not going the way you want it to go, how do you handle that? The flip side of that is that Marxism and socialism, right, more broadly, part of its fervor, right, comes from being critical of free market capitalism, the sins of free markets as they see them. And part of Marxism, of course, was making predictions, right, that capitalism was going to get worse and worse, and then ultimately fail and implode, and out of that, right, would come the revolution. And there's then an issue of not only that by the time we get to the 1950s, the socialist intellectuals can see that there are serious troubles with their theory, but they also can look at the relatively free market capitalist nations around the world, the United States, Canada, most of the Western European nations as well. And they can see that the countries that have gone more free market are all flourishing, right, and doing really well. And again, psychologically, how does that fit, right? When you have spent a significant amount of your intellectual career invested in being bitterly and violently opposed, right, to that movement? I would put it this way. If you just put it on a personal level, suppose you think of the person you hated the most in high school, right, or in middle school, right, who was kind of, you just didn't like this person, you didn't like you, right, and then you go to your high school reunion 20 years later, right, and right, you're working your dead end job, right, that you hate, and you're just going through your second divorce, right, and then your hated rival, right, shows up, right, in a beautiful car with a beautiful spouse and clearly is, you know, a multimillionaire and flourishing, right? So it's not just that you are despairing about where your life is, right, right now. It's just, I hate that guy, right? And that also, of course, is the way it was in the 1950s and the 1960s, because after World War II, the liberal capitalist countries, they picked themselves up. They started producing TVs. Everybody had a car. They're taking vacations. Life was pretty good, right? And that's a problem for the far left.
So, all right. So here is the thesis statement or the idea behind a lot of this. If you could sum it up, there is something religious about the nature of liberalism, Marxism, leftism, however you want to explain it. And for many people on the left, there's less enthusiasm for traditional religion because in some ways liberalism presents itself as an updated type of thinking. And one of the most trenchant aspects of liberalism is this claim that it's scientific. Now, it's no more scientific than the Greek or Roman myths, speaking of which, but because it's presented as science, presents itself as, or it sets itself up as beyond criticism. So, and maybe that was part of what Obama got away with, but it is this religious part of wanting to do charity or help people that I think is so seductive to liberals, and they don't seem to be able to escape it. All right, we'll take a little break here and come back. 523-1450, 747, flying those friendly skies on AM Las Cruces. 805-6180. I'll come back and get your texts. Kelly O'Connell on KOBE Radio. Somebody's asking what happened to your interview with Steve Pearce. I've got to figure out what happened is, and I was thinking what I could do. Maybe I can do this tomorrow. The way that it was recorded, I don't know, because I'm not a super tech guy. Steve called in and I did this interview. He could hear me, but when it was recorded, I guess it was just recording on his track. So what I could do is listen to the recording and then play it on the air and add my kind of basically what I asked him. Although people were saying it was kind of obvious what I asked him. All right. So here's text, more text. Oops. Why didn't the Columbian law professor, who is an expert in law, know that he was participating in a felony? He must have, right? Why didn't he advise his good friend James Comey about Comey's act leading to a felony? Comey and his contacts are deep in conspiracy. Now that Comey is gone, the FBI can do real law enforcement. All right, once again, I'm going to bring this thing up that there is this element of liberalism that suggests that post-law, it is post-rule. I don't know why that is. I'll have to think about it a little bit, but that's certainly an element of liberal, advanced liberal thinking. We've got a phone call. Thanks for the call, the Kelly O'Connell Show. Who's this?
It's Chuck.
Chuck, good morning. It's been a while, and I hope you're well, and what's on your mind?
Well, a couple real quick points. One, when I was in the military, if I had done anything even close to what Comey and Hillary Clinton had done, or the that woman who met with Clinton on the tarmac, if I'd done anything close to that, I would still be in Leavenworth. It's just unbelievable that
all
they
right,
get away with
but
this
Chuck,
stuff.
Chuck, I'm saying there is this sense in liberalism. They're fighting the battle for the revolution, and they want to – these people on the left are fighting for truth and reality, and they don't put themselves under any compunction, any rules.
Well, the thing is, the people who should be working against them are letting them get away with it.
Because they're part of the part of the problem, right?
Yeah, yeah. The Republican Party is – I dropped out of the Republican Party actively because what I saw controlling the party and guiding it in directions I didn't like. I stay registered with a party only to vote in the primary. That's
right.
The only reason. Now, going on to my second point, the media, all these attacks on the Trumps and everybody associated with them, right now, if they came up with anything that was real, I would probably not believe it.
Well,
it pushed me beyond the point of believing anything that they say.
Yeah, and somebody made a joke that if Trump used Russian salad dressing, they'd try to charge him for it. I've got another call, Chuck. Thanks for the call. Have a good day. Thanks for the call. The Kelly O'Connell Show. Who's this?
How you doing? This is O. I was just calling because, you know, I really think Trump needs to be allowed to do his job. You know, we give everybody an opportunity to do their job, and they're giving this guy such a hard time. Why not just concentrate on fixing the nation?
Well, you know, I've met some females who I was surprised to hear off the record. A couple of Hispanic females said they voted for him, and there is this sense across, I think, all aspects of American society that it's things are broken and we needed somebody to come and fix it.
Right. I mean, and who else can get us out of debt? Besides somebody who knows how to make millions. You know what I mean?
Billions.
A businessman.
I got another call. Good right. Points. Have a good day. Thanks for the call to Kelly O'Connell Show. Who's this?
In the words of the great John McEnroe,
you cannot be serious.
You cannot be serious. Foxborough Network are the only ones talking about Comey. Comey is home free. Why don't you talk about the criminality of the Donald Jr. guy, which is proof pudding that he was colluding with the Russians for the basis of the campaign.
Hey, I got a question for you. If he wasn't dealing with a government person, if the lady had not held herself out as a government person, where's the crime?
I don't care. The point is,
I'm asking.
Everybody is saying, they're all saying he's criminal. He's going to jail. He'll be going to jail before Comey.
Wait a second. I realize you're not religious, therefore you don't believe in prophecy, but your last prophetic statement went nowhere. You said that Donald, after Comey's statements to the Congress, was going to be out of office. Your ability to predict the future is terrible.
Hey, listen, you're 100% all the time. Bob Batten better than these criminals that you currently love that are operating the United States of America for the short period of time that we still exist.
Hey, let me ask you a question. Do you agree that your political beliefs take the place of a religion?
No. That's interesting you should say that. First off, there is no God, so therefore there can't be any religion. But they're all
Hold on a second. That's actually ridiculous. So you're saying that all of these things that we call religions don't exist because you don't believe there's a God? That the religion itself doesn't exist? Not the deity behind it, but all of the stuff in it doesn't exist? That's insane.
No, of course it's insane. A plant to some guy, that magic guy floating around the heavenly skies that's going to save you from yourself, that's insane.
But the government is going to come and save you, right, Frankie? Oh, that's not naive.
The United States government and many other governments out there take care of their people better
you know
than
what?
God.
I feel better. That's so touching. Maybe Santa Claus will make a revival, too. Anything else?
No, you have a nice
day. You too. All right, Frankie, once again. There's no there in his statements. All right, Kelly, it's not a nothing burger. It is a full of blank burger. You guys are standing up in it, up to your eyeballs, and wouldn't say the word if you had a mouthful. Kathy, actually, Carhy, K-A-R-H-Y. Also, I don't cry about this crap, but it does nauseate me. But I must say, he has already done way more than I thought even he would do. He is everything I thought he would be. Kathy, well, I guess you're a prophet, Kathy. On Obama, if I would have been on my toes, I could have said at least he got us out of two wars. Really? ISIS getting set up to attack us was getting us out of a war, but who knows? It's no longer about oil. It's ISIS. They don't need to hold land to spread their beliefs. They're getting beat, Kathy. Did you know that? All right. Need to euthanize you con kooks. That's from Frankie. Very rational. I suspect Frankie is Kathy. It should be listed as child abuse. And for Melissa, put the thing on pause and tell us your questions on the air. Oh, okay, well, I'll do that tomorrow. All right, I'm going to see if I have time for... I don't think I have time for your comedy clip here. But let me see. No, I don't think so. Today, the second hour is going to be comedy-free, except for Frankie's statements. All right, it was wonderful to hang out with you. Thanks for a lot of great calls. Haven't heard from people I haven't heard from in a while. Chuck O, the mysterious O. I wonder if he's related to uh-oh. Chris Christie intentionally sparked Beachgate to boost his chances of getting a sports talk radio after leaving office, claims Bill O'Reilly. I think that's true. He looked like a beach whale. Sitting all by himself in the sand. Tower of Human Skulls unearthed in Mexico. I'll talk to you about that tomorrow. How to raise successful children? Tomorrow. Gonorrhea oral sex is causing the spread of untreatable super gonorrhea, World Health Organization warns. Why doesn't Obama fight against that? Take on something his own size. Jolted man who caused massive explosion when he cut a gas pipe in his home and failed suicide bid after splitting from his partner is jailed for more than 2 years. His partner, a male who they broke up, Kevin Carroll, you should see this. He blew up like five houses. They were row houses. OMG. Back in anger, Kathy. Come on now. Let's look forward. 7:59, Kelly O'Connell. Have a great day. Meet you back in 22 hours. Ciao.